Will AI ultimately make free market economics obsolete and destroy democracy in favor of a digital democracy? Some credentialed futurists think so. That's the topic today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. Will infotech and biotech erode human agency, subvert human desires, and render free market economics obsolete? At first glance, there looks to be a wide gap between the future of AI and the destruction of democracy. In a cheery little column published in The Atlantic, Yuval Noah Harari posits AI will ultimately destroy democracy and favor digital dictatorships. What is his argument, and does it hold any water? That's the topic today we'll be discussing with our guest, Dr. Jay Richards. Jay Richards has a PhD in philosophy and theology with honors from Princeton Theological Seminary. He holds a professor position at the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America and is the executive editor of The Stream. The Stream, which I am becoming more familiar with, is a resource that champions, and this is on their website, it champions freedom, smaller government, and human dignity. The site authoritatively challenges the worst in mainstream media and does not shy away from the topic of God. Really good stuff. It's available online at stream.org. Not thestream.org, but stream.org. Jay is also a senior fellow at the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. He has written many interesting books, two of which I have read, The Privileged Planet, co-authored with Guillermo Gonzalez, and his latest book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. As you would suppose from the title of the book, Jay has expertise in the topic of AI and its future impact. Jay, I have to confess with you, I didn't read your book. I listened to it. have you listened to your book yet?
I haven't listened to it, but I did put in the request with the publisher that they release the audiobook simultaneous with the hardcover, because that's honestly what I do. I've gotten to where I initially now, at least with nonfiction books, I listen to them first. And then if I need the references, actually, then I buy it. So sometimes Amazon gets me both for an Audible and for a hard or a paperback. So I do the same thing.
Ditto here. I listen to the book, and if I do need the references, or sometimes you can't see the figures, you have to actually buy the book from them. Jay, Harari forecasts that AI could transform democracy into a tyranny. Who is Yuval Noah Harari? I know you said you've read a couple of his books.
I have. And so, I mean, he's actually a historian of medieval history. He's an Israeli historian. He's actually at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He got his PhD at Jesus College in Oxford. And for years, he was writing sort of on his discipline. But here in the last 10 years or so, he's been writing on these, I don't know what you want to call this, kind of macro history, these sweeping histories of everything. And so two fairly recent books, one called Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, and then a really recent one from 2016, it's called Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow. And so the first book, Sapiens, it proposes to sort of give us a history of all of human history and anchor us back in cosmic history. This Homo Deus, as you might guess, you know, man, the god, is a kind of a speculative history of the future and where he actually imagines things going. This recent piece in The Atlantic, I think, sort of fits into that category. For listeners that haven't ever heard of him, think of him as a hardcore scientistic reductionist who thinks that the kind of materialistic take on science at any particular moment trumps actually any other source of knowledge or anything you might suspect, and who also buys the sort of strong AI program. So he assumes that at some point here in the next 25 years, technology is going to supersede us. And so he buys that whole program. And so that's, you know, this just follows in line with where he's been going. And this actually very depressing piece in The Atlantic fits perfectly with certainly the intellectual trajectory he's had for the last several years.
So what in your mind is a summary of his objectives in the piece? As I mentioned in the introduction, I called it a cheery little article, and I hope the idea that cheery was what's meant to be, what's the word?
Sarcastic.
Sarcastic, exactly. So I hope the sarcasm came across. No, it was very depressing. What was your impression of it in general? What was he trying to do?
In general, essentially he is glomming on to this claim that we're reaching a point in which artificial intelligence and robotics are going to make a lot of the human race obsolete. And he focuses in particular on manual labor, but also on cognitive work. And he thinks, as many of the other prognosticators do, that this is going to make a lot of people irrelevant. It's going to make a lot of people's activities have absolutely no economic value. But the twist he makes on this is that he also thinks that this is likely to lead to a tyranny, a sort of digital dictatorship of a few elites who control the masses. And I should say, this is quite the change from the book that he wrote, Sapiens, before the 2016 election, in which he predicted the end of nationalism and the end of the nation state. And then lo and behold, Donald Trump gets elected, Brexit happens, and now he thinks liberal democracy is all kaput, and in fact we're heading for some kind of dictatorship. And so, as I said, I mean, this piece is in the Atlantic, but Harari is in many ways a kind of Geiger counter of elite conventional wisdom, and he certainly doesn't disappoint in this piece.
Well, the collapse of democracy into tyranny, he makes some points, and let me play his side. Maybe he has some good points. He talks, for example, about Nazi Germany as an example, and how they were having all of this economic and nationalism upheaval, and it was a democracy, and that's how Hitler got in and became a tyrant.
No, that's right. And this is a difficulty with his piece, is that he uses the word democracy over and over, but I'm never quite sure what he's talking about. Sometimes when he uses it, I think what he means is representative government. Other times, it seems like he's talking about limited government. Sometimes I think he's talking about free markets. Other times he's talking about, I think, just the idea that people have individual rights and that every individual ought to be respected. Well, that's a kind of bundle of ideas. I would say that's a cluster of really good ideas that were developed in Western civilization. But it's not exactly clear that that's what he's talking about. Yes, the American founders were quite opposed to democracy, if by that word you meant popular democracy, because that would just end up being a sort of dictatorship of the majority. And so, unfortunately, by never defining these terms in any way, I'm never quite sure what his argument is. When I first looked at the title of the piece, I thought he was going to talk about the danger of the surveillance state and the possibility that the government, can obviously monitor what we're doing much more profoundly and in greater detail than it could at any time in the past. But that's actually not what he talks about. Insofar as he has a detailed point, he talks about the ownership of data, which I do think is a problem. We have to think about, okay, what kind of barriers do we put up in order to protect our privacy? What are we going to do about the ownership of personal data that technology companies can get a hold of? But all of those perfectly legitimate points, I think, kind of get lost in this sort of grandiose materialistic vision that is really the sort of backdrop for his argument.
Let me read you some of the quotes that come from his article and get your reaction to them. I certainly had strong reactions to them. One of them is, democracy success in the 20th century depended on unique technological conditions that may prove ephemeral.
I have no idea what he could be talking about here. This is the oddest thing. First of all, of course, everyone that takes a civics course knows that America is a republic, not a democracy. But let's grant him that point, right? But none of these depended upon the 20th century technologies, obviously. I mean, the American founding happened two and a half centuries earlier. So I can't imagine what he can possibly be talking about. And then, if you think about sort of the growth of economic freedom, for instance, well, there's been a huge amount of growth in economic freedom since 1990. In fact, the number of people living in absolute poverty has been cut in half globally since 1990. But none of it was dependent upon 20th century technology. It was based upon institutions, rule of law, limited government, checks and balances, economic freedom. These things, none of these are technological things. They're cultural and institutional things. And so this is why I honestly think he's using the word democracy as a kind of bundle term to refer to a heck of a lot of different things. And this is the perfect example of this, the idea that democracy depends on unique technological conditions of the 20th century. It's just a very weird claim by itself.
It does seem to be weird. As I mentioned, I think he makes a lot of suppositions and then jumps a big chasm to the conclusions. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of the cases. Technology, definitely. The only thing that I could come up with, and let me get your reaction on this, is technically superior in a military sense. Certain sure. democracy would not have survived had there not been the technological superiority of the Allies in World War II over the Nazis and the Japanese with the atomic bomb Enigma, the Norton bomb site, Alan Turing cracking Enigma and things of that sort. So do you think that could have been a connection?
Well, I honestly think that what you're giving a better version of his argument than he provides, because he doesn't say anything about that. He seems to think that, in fact, this sort of he seems to actually think that somehow economic freedom itself, limited government, sort of wide play for economic exchange, that somehow this depends on technology. Whereas if he was saying, well, if it hadn't been for the atomic bomb and the American military and the Allies, democracy might have lost, he could have made that argument, but of course he doesn't. And as we know from history, I mean, if things had turned out slightly differently and Nazis had held on for a couple more years, they might actually have gotten a nuclear bomb before we did. So, it's very hard even to reconstruct this particular point, even charitably in a version that makes sense, except that I just think we have to say he's using democracy to refer to, it's kind of all the things he likes and thinks are generally a good thing that he's worried we're going to lose.
Okay. Yeah, if you watched The Man in the High Castle, it's yes. a program which supposes that the Nazis had developed the bomb first and had used it to win World War II. And so there are these alternative history sort of ways of thinking about things.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, this is, again, I think that because Harari is so sort of impressive as a public intellectual, he's had these international bestsellers. But sometimes I think when you read him, you're tempted to think, okay, he must have some subtle thing happening here. But I honestly think if you understand him as a widely read, but actually kind of intellectually shallow materialist and reductionist, that gives you the kind of hermeneutical key you need to follow his argument.
Yeah, I had difficulty. Okay, let me give you another quote.
Yeah.
Quote, ordinary people may not understand artificial intelligence and biotechnology in any detail, but they can sense the future is passing them by. Then he goes on to say, most people in Birmingham, Istanbul, St. Petersburg, and Mumbai are only dimly aware, if they are aware at all, of the rise of AI and its potential impact on their lives.
This, again, is a funny sort of thing in which clearly, an intellectual elite channels what he thinks people in Birmingham are thinking. But I don't know if he's talking about Birmingham, England, or Birmingham, Alabama here, but probably both. But the reality is, at least, if you look at the economic indicators in the United States, that doesn't seem to be the general impression that people have. There is, I've looked at these polls, and a lot of people do think artificial intelligence and robotics are going to replace a lot of people's jobs. But most people also think they're going to replace other people's jobs and not their own, strangely enough. Now, I do think the disruption of information technology is something that we really need to grapple with, especially the rapidity of disruption in this particular era. But I think what he's doing is he's channeling the elite angst of people who believe in the strong AI program and expect machines to literally replace us. But I honestly think the ordinary person, unless they're watching sci-fi, this isn't the main thing that they're actually worried about. Whether they should or not, it's a good question. But he sort of imagines that, well, these people don't really understand, but in fact, their lives and their livelihood are going to be overturned. So it's the sort of channeling of an intellectual elite, someone like Karl Marx, who claims to speak for the textile factory workers, but never bothers to go to the textile factory and actually interview anyone.
Yeah, exactly. I was really troubled by his use of ordinary people. That certainly smacks immediately of elitism.
Definitely.
I often come to work early and go to a McDonald's here. and I sit down with some of the people that work, for example, ordinary people, if you will, that work in the mess halls, that and actually homeless people. And you talk to them, and I think some of them do live in silos, but I tell you, a lot of them know what's going on. I don't think the ordinary person should be underestimated in their knowledge of what is going on.
Absolutely.
I think that's very dangerous.
And it's not like you need to know how the internet works, right? Or how your computer works to be plugged in. I mean, the truth of the matter is people that are virtually everyone, you know, in the United States is connected to social media and using email and these sorts of things. And so it's not like technical knowledge is required in order to be able to access these things.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I tell you what, they all have cell phones. So
absolutely.
At least.
And speaking of homeless people, when I lived in Seattle, we always had a lunch for the homeless on Sundays. And my youngest daughter would say, "Well, Daddy, why do the homeless people all have iPhones?" I never actually had a good answer for that, but that shows you how ubiquitous it is.
It is. And I think it shows that certainly they know at least a little bit of what is happening in AI, number one. And number two, that is a little portal to all of the knowledge in the world.
Absolutely.
And if they're curious at all, they certainly can find out some different things. Okay. Here's a related quote from Harari. It's section two, a new useless class. He says, most of the new jobs will presumably demand high levels of expertise and ingenuity, and therefore may not provide an answer to the problem of unemployed, unskilled laborers or workers employable only at extremely low wages.
Well, this is the popular impression, but as you know, Bob, about Moravec's paradox, we can, yes, we can make machines that can beat the reigning champions at Jeopardy or beat the reigning champion at chess. We can't build a robot that can do what any competent three-year-old can do with his hands. And so, you know, I often tell people, look, there are going to be a lot of sort of easily, you know, easily reducible jobs, jobs that can be reduced to rules, sort of highly repetitive jobs, say in factories or in the office. Yeah, those are likely to get replaced. They're likely to get mechanized in some way. The landscaper and the carpenter and the housekeeper, actually, those are much tougher nuts to crack. I also think that there's a whole new class of jobs that are just now coming to the fore that I call bespoke labor, in which people suddenly, when things like food and various goods become cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, people suddenly start preferring highly specialized things. So even though people can buy sort of mass-produced, factory-farmed produce at their local grocery store, they're perfectly happy to spend five times more and go to the farmer's market and to get locally sourced and pasture-raised chicken and eggs and cows and pork. And I think that what's actually happening is that we're going to have a double economy in which lots of things are produced very cheaply in a mechanized way, and yet people are going to prefer these kind of interesting bespoke services and labor, just as people can, you can buy a cheap cup of coffee at any diner, but people still spend $4 getting a fancy coffee at Starbucks.
I never understood that.
No, but it's, you know, economists know that people choose things, we value things for our own personal reasons. And so you can't really reduce what people choose to kind of simple economic calculation. Because really, when people are buying coffee at Starbucks, they're not just buying coffee. They're buying a coffee-related experience. They're buying the atmosphere. They're buying the kind of the signaling of what it means to meet there. It's a bunch of other things. And I think it's the same thing with a lot of these interesting agricultural choices that people make. They just want something that was served to them and made by a person that they have a relationship with. And so, you know, whether that makes sense or not, I think that's what people tend to choose. And I think we'll actually see more of that in the future.
Absolutely. I want to return to something that you mentioned previously, which is Moravec's paradox. And I found that fascinating. I just learned about Moravec's paradox, I don't know, 6 months ago or something. Could you give an explanation of what that is? You did a little bit, but I think this was actually discovered in the early days of AI research, yes?
Yes, exactly. It's named after a famous robotics professor named Hans Moravec, and it's basically the idea that it's easier to reduce knowledge that is knowledge about something, so data, you know, or something that can be reduced to an algorithm or a system of rules. We're really good at using machines to do those kinds of things. So maybe, you know, sorting things into a database according to particular properties. On the other hand, things that involve complex movement in three-dimensional space. So the stuff that we do, the know-how, that you learn how to do something with your hands, to sculpt or to play golf, that's a much tougher nut to crack because there's all these complex feedbacks. You know, I've got some green tea here with me and I pick up the glass and I know about what the hardness of the glass and its weight, in part because I'm getting this complex feedback between my eyes and the tips of my fingers and my arm. The computational resources to actually pull that off are really, really vast. And so we're good at building robots, for instance, that do one or a few tasks over and over, and they can do it much faster than a human could ever do. But this kind of general body movement, it's an entirely different problem. And so this is why if you go to an Amazon fulfillment center, the thing is just an amazing feat of automation with forklifts that pick up pallets of goods without anyone monitoring or driving them. And yet right at the end of the process, you have human beings taking the products and putting them in boxes because wow. At the moment, it's only humans that have the ability to say, oh, that's a roll of toilet paper. That's a fragile champagne glass. Oh, that's an iPod. We can do that. And so I'm not saying that we'll never develop robots that can do those kinds of things, but the idea that jobs involving that are going to be the first to go, I think it's deeply misguided. People that actually know something about robotics know that, no, that's going to be much more difficult. The kind of labor jobs that I would expect to disappear would be the ones in which people are doing really, really simple things in an assembly line. The irony there is those types of jobs are only a century or so old. The assembly line was invented by Henry Ford, and socialists at the time complained. They said, well, that is men doing the work of machines. They're just doing this kind of mindless, repetitive work. And to which I say, well, I think they probably had a point. And there was a moment in economic history in which we needed people to do that. I do think those types of jobs will become obsolete. It doesn't follow, as any smart economist will tell you, that there won't be any other jobs for people to do, or that all the jobs will require technical knowledge. Nothing in economic history would tell us that. Machines replace current ways of doing things, and then we discover new things that we can do given the new economic situation.
The free enterprise system in capitalism is very robust in correcting.
It is. And that's what's funny about Harari's article, because he talks about both democracy and the free market. And in fact, he argues that, well, one reason that markets worked in the 20th century is that markets are better at sorting goods and services. And so a dictator, for instance, or a committee in the Soviet Union, they couldn't figure out how to price things. So they would just come up with fake prices and fake production quotas. And so it never did work. It didn't work as well as a market in which people are buying and selling and estimating they want based in part on price signals. But then he argues in this piece that, of course, now we're going to have these amazing computers that can do all these really fast calculations. And so then we can have an economic dictator that can actually do all these things. But this is only somebody that's never actually read any economics would make this argument, because the point about the reason the market works better than a command economy, it's not a calculation problem. The argument is that, look, what a market is millions of people making subjective evaluations about how much they value something at a particular moment. And how much I value a glass of water at one moment is going to differ from how much I value it, say, right after I've had a glass of water. And so the argument against central planning is that no matter how quick you could calculate it, nobody has access to all the economic judgments that people make at any particular moment. And so the only way to distribute goods and services that takes account of that is a market with the rule of law and a price system. And then the prices signal all of that information. And so Harari here, he's completely out of his depth when he starts talking about economics. And honestly, I thought I think he's only ever kind of gotten these arguments from a distance. And so he's just sort of wandered into an area that, unfortunately, he's a smart guy. He could learn this very quickly, but he clearly hasn't.
Yeah, that was my takeaway also, that I'm the last to invoke the idea of a genetic fallacy in any sort of discussion, but a person needs to get outside of their own silo and acquire the domain expertise they need if they're going to talk about a specific topic. Jay, we're out of time. Would you continue this in a follow-up episode?
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Okay, great. So that concludes things today. There will be a follow-up episode on Mind Matters with Dr. Jay Richards. And until then, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.today. That's mindmatters.today. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.